So, sorry, what? I want to begin by talking about a game which I personally haven't played, and which I think very few people have played, because it's a game which has made much of an impact on the history of games and the development of the medium. But that is a game called Darkstone from back in 1999, but what I'm actually interested in, just to start off this presentation, was the kind of advertising campaign which ran magazines at the time of the game's release. And that was a series of images which all followed this kind of format. So on one side of the page, we have a picture of a kind of very regular looking kind of person. And on the other side of the page, we have this kind of description of a character that this person embodies in this particular game. And there was a whole sequence of these. All of them kind of, you know, young white men for obvious cultural reasons. But again, on the other side, we have this kind of quite generic heroic fantasy character that they're choosing to play in this kind of game. And all of these images built up to this particular punchline. You know, the game telling you to bid farewell to your former self. And that is not a particularly kind of new or unique message even back in 1999. This idea that a digital game or a virtual world in general can be used as a way to become someone else, you know, presumably someone better, more satisfying, someone I said that you can be happier with in whatever way, has been part of popular and academic discourses regarding virtual worlds for a long time. David Gunkel refers to this as this kind of ideology of self-fulfillment and reinvention in digital games, right? This idea that you can become the hero you always wanted to be. You can be strong and brave and intelligent and whatever, and all those things that you wish you might be in real life but are not. And we can see other examples of this kind of idea in play. This was a book which was published by the photographer Robbie Cooper back in 2007. This is me kind of trying to capture the kind of holographic cover that it has. But this was essentially a photography project where Cooper interviewed various people and talked about their online identities in various kinds of virtual worlds. So the book always follows this kind of double-paged format, right? Where you have an actual person and then their avatar in whatever virtual world it is that they engage with. And of course, these took various kinds of forms. And there's always kind of comments that the person gives about the choices they made regarding the identity that they're playing in the virtual world. And we see all kinds of relations that different people kind of adopted towards their in-game selves. So for example, this person said, you know, she created someone who kind of looks quite a bit like her real self, perhaps a little bit idealized, a little bit optimized. But then you also have people who talked about why they chose someone who looks very different from themselves or who has very different characteristics from their own self. This person talking about his avatar in Lineage, arguing for the place where, you know, he feels less constrained in terms of being who he would like to be. There being less kind of societal pressures to be a certain kind of person. People talking about having a kind of avatar that reflects an inner self or aspect of the self, which again, they might not be as able to actualize in their other venues of their life. And we see a lot of discussion in kind of academic literature regarding avatar use. So for example, there have been discussions about digital games and virtual worlds being used as platforms for identity exploration, right? For exploring different ways of presenting oneself. Even if, as Lisa Nakamura argued, it's actually, you know, empirically seems to be quite rare for people to adopt, to kind of create avatars which are entirely different from themselves. The norm does tend to be that people do create avatars and adopt identities in virtual world, which might not be exactly who they are in the actual world, but tends to have some similarity. Again, research kind of identifies that most users do seem to attempt to recreate some version of their real self, even if that's idealized. But still, you know, games do offer the opportunity for editing that self, for kind of, you know, changing those things about yourself you would like, and presenting yourself in a way that you might prefer. So again, virtual worlds can be used as a venue for building a desired self, which was in the, I wish I were like X, whatever X might be. And as a way of kind of constituting one's conceptual self, of experimenting with oneself, of figuring out new ways of presenting oneself. Now, a lot of this research, which I'm quoting here, this tends to be coming from a kind of social scientific background. This is, generally speaking, kind of empirical social scientific research, which looks at actual users of virtual worlds. And it adopts a certain kind of assumption. So in a lot of this research, the emphasis is very much on the appearance of the avatar. Do you choose to play an avatar with a particular gender or ethnic kind of presentation? Do you choose an avatar with a particular kind of outfit and costume? So there's a lot of emphasis here on how users choose to present themselves visually. And relatedly, the focus does tend to be on social performance. The focus does tend to be on identity and self being understood in terms of how you present yourself to others. Now, all of that is, again, so for example, Villa Nieto talked about the idea of virtual self-representation to others. Now, and all of that is interesting, but it's not exactly my focus. I'm kind of interested in building upon this by talking not about this sense of, not this kind of social or primarily social sense of presenting oneself to others by appearing in a certain way, but about something like a more internal feeling of how is it that we can use games as a way to explore being otherwise, and having this kind of internal experience of relating to the world and being in the world in a certain way which might be different from the ways in which you kind of usually relate to the world. So in my talk, I'm going to follow these kind of main sections. I'm going to try to keep it, you know, relatively brief and within time, so I'll go a bit fast. So first, I begin by talking about a concept which you know, I've been focusing on a lot in my own research, which is this idea of ludic subjectivity, and the idea that you can use a game as a way of being otherwise, of being a different kind of person, you know, like when we have the kind of discourse, which I get Glunkel identifies as this ideology of reinvention and so on. What does it mean when we say a game can give you the experience of being otherwise, of being someone else? Here I'm drawing on a kind of tradition within game studies, which has, broadly speaking, been referred to as existential ludology. And that's this kind of tradition of drawing on existential and phenomenological philosophy to talk about our experiences in digital games. The kind of foundation assumption of this way of looking at games is, as Sebastian Möhring argues, the idea that there's a kind of corollary between the way we kind of existentially relate to the actual world and the way we existentially relate to virtual worlds. That there's a kind of mirroring or repetition that our existence in virtual world follows the kind of same kind of existential structures by which we relate to the actual world. And, you know, there's been a kind of number of arguments and a kind of concepts which have emerged from that. Reno kind of develops Sartre's idea of the human condition to refer to the gameplay condition. In some of my earlier work, I kind of proposed this idea of the ludic subject position, which refers to this kind of existential standpoint that the game gives you in relation to its world. Marta Kanye talks about the gameplay situation, again, to refer to this existential situatedness that we have in virtual worlds. So let me kind of dig into that a little bit more. What do I mean when I talk about the ludic subject position? What do I mean when I say that the game positions you in a certain existential standpoint. In quite, let's say, concrete form of things, I'm talking about like a system of formal structures which a game uses to place you in a certain way. And these generally relate to the player's kind of embodiment in a particular figure. We generally call it the avatar or the playable character. And first of all, having that kind of virtual body in that virtual world gives you a spatial standpoint, right? It gives you a here. When we say things like, there's an enemy in front of me, or there's something to my left or to my right, and we're not referring to my left, my right, and I'm kind of sitting on the couch with the controller in my hands, but we're talking about that that spatial standpoint that the game gives me, that here within the virtual world, which is represented by my incorporation within that body. Usually that gives me kind of a visual point of view and an auditory standpoint related to that body, right? What I can see, what I can hear. So my experience of the game world is anchored within that body. And my understanding of the game world is also anchored by the capabilities and limitations of that body. So what I can and cannot do within the game world based on the affordances that the game gives me shapes the experiential form that that world takes for me. Right? What is dangerous to me? What is it that I can and cannot do in the world? And that kind of shapes the meaning that that world has for me. Relatedly, it's not just about the capabilities and the limitations, but the goals that we are set within that world, right? And towards which we orient those capabilities. The goals I have in that world will determine what will be important to me in the game world, what will not be important, what is an obstacle to achieving those goals, what helps me in achieving those goals. So again, the experienced meaning of things in that virtual world depends on the goals which I am set, or which I am allowed to set for myself. Finally, I'm using the word passion here, not in the kind of, let's say, more colloquial contemporary meaning, but in a slightly more archaic sense, that's kind of the obverse of action. But of course, with a game, and the fact that you have a body in the game, that the body doesn't just allow you to act upon the game world, but also allows the other entities in the game world to act upon you. Right? So to also have this kind of passive experience of being acted upon, being vulnerable to entities within the game world. So if we stick to this example of I'm using the Breath of the Wild as an example, but it could be kind of almost any game I'm talking about. This game gives you a particular kind of overarching goal that you have to achieve. Right, you need to get into the castle in the middle of the game world and defeat this, you know, great evil which is there. And you start off, you kind of place in a particular body, you start off in this particular place in the game world. You're at the start of the game relatively weak. You see that you have three hearts up there. You have no weapons, no equipment. And to a great extent, you know, the 100 plus hours you're going to spend probably to complete the game is about making yourself into the kind of being within that world that can complete that goal. And part of that means acquiring equipment and armor, increasing your stats, you see how many hearts you have now at the end of the game. But apart from that, in a kind of more internal way, it also means kind of internalizing what the game asks of you in terms of learning the skills you require, for example, learning to use the game's affordances to navigate its landscape in a particular way, like in this case, the glider, learning the kind of patterns which its combat requires, learning how to understand what is and isn't relevant, and in a general way, kind of shaping your way of being into that world until you become the kind of person who can complete the goal of the game. Now, of course, you might also decide that you actually don't care about, you know, defeating this great evil. You don't care about achieving the main goal that the game suggests you should complete. Maybe what you care about is finding the 999 Korok seeds that are hidden in this virtual world. I've only ever managed to find about 100 of them, so I'm way behind on this. If you do that, then you are going to behave very differently in that virtual world. This is your goal rather than completing the main quest. then things which you would not have paid attention to will now become very relevant. Like you might move through the game world very slowly, looking out for kind of strange textures or kind of particular arrangements of rocks or things like that. Again, different things will come to the fore of your attention, while, you know, a really powerful weapon and so on, which would have been very relevant if you focused on the main quest, is less relevant. By adopting a different goal within the virtual world, you are now playing out a different kind of self within that virtual world, and you're adopting a very different comportment or a very different way of being towards that world. Gadamer, who's one of the many philosophers who has spoken about play, not specifically about video games, but about games in general, argued, you know, he gave a lot of importance to this idea of the goal of play. Right? Every game gives the player a task, he argued. But the purpose isn't really completing the task. You know, we don't really necessarily care so much about what it is that we're trying to do with the play, but the fact that by trying to achieve that goal, we are pushed into adopting a particular kind of comportment. So pursuing a game's goals with the means that the game gives me pushes me to exist in a certain way. And every game has its particular comportment, right? One can be assertive, one can be thoughtful, one can be whatever it is that particular game demands of me. So a very different game, but so Dark Souls is a game which is famously very difficult. If you are anything like me, you play this game, and when you play this game, you adopt a particular kind of comportment. You, especially if you're venturing into a new area where you don't know what kind of dangers await and so on, you will advance, you know, extremely slowly, very carefully, shield up, very defensively, very meticulously, kind of watching out for any possible danger which might lie ahead and so on. So that's a particular kind of comportment which emerges through the extreme vulnerability that the game positions you in. A later game from the same designers pushes you to adopt a very different comportment. So here you no longer have a shield. You cannot adopt a defensive comportment. You can kind of block with the sword, but also, apart from the lack of a shield, the game also bases its combat on breaking an enemy's stamina. So in order to kind of break an enemy's defenses, you have to attack repeatedly until they're tired out, and then you actually do damage to them. So here, the comportment you have to adopt is kind of directly opposite to Dark Souls, right? You cannot have that kind of slow, defensive kind of comportment. Need to have a kind of much faster, more aggressive kind of way of putting yourself out there and, you know, taking risks. That's a kind of game with a very, very different kind of comportment. So has anyone played Untitled Blue's game here? A couple of people, all right. So this is a game where you play a horrible goose. I'm not making any kind of value judgment here. This is the game designer's work. You know, it's a wonderful game, the village, and you're a horrible goose. That's the tagline of the game. Again, you're given, so by being put in this virtual body, you are given a certain set of capabilities and limitations. You can hide in, you know, tall vegetation, you can grab things, and you can honk, which usually startles people. So these kind of abilities are then oriented towards a particular set of goals which you're given in each area of the game. Things like this, which are generally kind of various forms of, mischief and low-level troublemaking. When I played this game, it's very easy to internalize this kind of mischievous way of being and to start also thinking beyond the kind of official set of goals that you have. For example, in this kind of first area where you're in this kind of garden and there's a groundskeeper and you're making his life generally miserable, at some point I figured out that it was possible for me to that at least in theory it's impossible to lock the groundskeeper out of the garden. Because you know, you can lead him out and you can steal his keys and then you can anyway. And once I realized that was possible, even though it wasn't officially part of the goal, I'm like, of course I have to try to do that. Right? Like, how can I not? You know, I really wanted to do that because I had internalized this kind of mischievous comportment, this mischievous way of being. As soon as I did that, the game kind of revealed that that was one of the secret goals which I could have discovered. So again, it was kind of pushing for you to adopt that kind of comportment beyond the official goals. Céline Nguyen has written about games in a recent-ish book where I refer to games as a library of agencies. Each game suggests a particular mode of agency. You know, as he said, one can focus on speed, one on elegance, one on precise look ahead, and so on. So having a variety of games, kind of each of which embodies a particular mode of agency, gives us this kind of library that we can choose between. Now, I wouldn't necessarily go as far as he does in privileging agency. Of course, agency and acting and doing things is a key component of games, but you know, as I tried to kind of suggest earlier, we also have kind of like receptive and passive dimension and vulnerable dimensions to being in games. But this idea of every game kind of giving you a particular comportment and a particular way of being is something that I do agree with. To kind of bring this back to some of the existential philosophy, which kind of I've drawn in some of my own work, Sartre, who's also a philosopher who's written about play, although not extensively, there's like two or three pages in the, you know, 600 page being and nothingness, but quite crucial pages, I think. He argues that when we adopt a playful attitude, when we are playing, we are adopting an attitude where the act is not its own goal. So there he's reacting against some kind of ideas of play which suggest that play are actions we take on for their own sake. And he says, not exactly. It's true that when we're playing, we're not kind of motivated by, you know, financial or economic or any other kind of external motivation, but it's not that we're doing play for the sake of the action itself, but rather the fact that by acting in a certain way, we are being in a certain way. So the desire to play is fundamentally the desire to be a particular kind of person, to be a particular kind of way. And so the desire to play a particular kind of game and adopt the particular comportment which that game suggests, you know, the mischievous comportment of a dice and clues game, the active assertive comportment of Sekiro, is the desire to explore that kind of self, that kind of, you know, being that a certain way. And in this sense, you know, there have been some people, including, you know, Feng, who's in this room, but also Fallon Parker before that, who have written about using computer games as a technology for a kind of aesthetic kind of self-fashioning. And I was kind of amused a while back, you know, when the game came out, to see these images from a protest march. Obviously, it was like an anti-Brexit protest march in the UK, which suggested a way in which the kind of comportment the game suggests can become externalized beyond the game into other aspects of life and so on. So that was probably the longest section. The others are a little bit shorter. So if this is the concrete ways in which games can be used as ways of exploring a kind of different way of being, what is the significance of this? Of this kind of, let's say, existential dimension of play. I'll start with this kind of longish quote from Eugen Fink, who is a philosopher who's written more extensively about play. This is from a book called Play, a Symbol of the World. So I'll start with this kind of cheerful thought. So Fink argues when we live in our lives, we can understand the kind of degenerate part of human life as a contraction of possibilities. that, as in a sense, when we're at the start of life, when we are infants, we are nothing yet. We have not actualized any of our possibilities, so we are initially nothing. But the corollary to that is that we are still infinitely, potentially everything. You know, we can still potentially be a pop star or an astronaut or, you know, anything we would like to be. As you grow older, you kind of make some choices, or circumstances make choices for you. Some of those possibilities are actualized at the cost of all the other possibilities that, of course, disappear. All right, so as he says, the child is indeterminately everything, the old man is determinately little. We are born as many and die as one. Yeah, cheerful thought. But he goes on to ask, okay, so given the, let's say, existential despair that this thought is likely to provide, how do we get around that? And he says, essentially, play is our way of dealing with that. Because in play, he says, we again, we can kind of gain some of those possibilities again. We can't explore those possibilities of being which we have had to let go in our lives. Even if only in the dimension of a mere appearance, right? When we're playing an as if. When we're playing, he says, of course, play, by his understanding, isn't a kind of free-floating, imaginary exercise of make-believe. We always play in relation to actual things. We use toys, objects, whatever it is. He gives the example of a child playing with a doll. The doll is a material thing. It is an object we can hold that has certain affordances and possibilities. But when we are playing, on the basis of those material things, those beings we encounter, we project this domain of appearance that he calls the play world. So every act of play is a creative process which brings about this domain of appearance superimposed upon the objects of play, right? So again, his example, there's a girl playing with a doll. This play world is projected by her act of play, in which the doll becomes a child. Within the play world, it's not just the toys, the objects, which gain a new meaning, but also the player. So within the play world, the girl holding the doll becomes the child's mother. And pertaining to the act of play, there is a particular mode which she will adopt, right? So she will fulfill the role of mother in relation to the doll. So for Fink, every act of play involves this kind of doubling, right? Where a non-actual comportment is portrayed to an actual comportment. So the girl holding the doll is actually doing something, right? She's holding the subject, she's related to the subject in a certain way, but through that, this comportment of care is projected. And of course, for the girl, that might be a comportment which reflects an aspect of herself which doesn't have, let's say, another avenue in her actual life to be portrayed. So he think argues we always have this kind of doubling. This is always present, right? When we're in any kind of play situation, this doubling between the player's actual self, let's say, and the self that they adopt within the play is always going to be present. Sorry. So he talks about the mask as kind of representing some idea of what the existential meaning of play is. When we were a mask, there's a kind of self-transformation which is happening. Of course, when you wear a mask, you don't stop being who you are, right? You don't, let's say, magically stop. I don't magically stop being Daniel, right? You remain who you are, but by means of the mask, you are transposed into the possibility of appearing ambiguously and fully seamlessly. Like, you might have had the experience of seeing, let's say, someone, you know, take on a role in a play or some kind of game or something like that, and suddenly seeing perhaps quite surprisingly, maybe even shockingly, right, a very different side of them. Right, someone who might normally be shy become the opposite. You know, someone display a side of themselves within a role which seems very different from who they are. And of course, there's a context for that. You might say this is the role in the play, this is the game, this is the act, you know, this person is acting. But still, that is coming from somewhere. That is coming from some aspect of that person. So Fink argues, the masking's idea of play pushes us into the sense that, you know, we aren't just one. We aren't just this one person who we actualize in our everyday life. We can be ambiguous. We can be multiple. So as he says, the mask and this idea of the role in play releases us from the inescapable fixity and the rigidity of our life situation. Right? We can be everything again. If we have enough masks, if we have enough games, enough different comportments to explore, we can do it. We can explore all those possibilities of ourselves. And again, you know, this relates, obviously, Fink was writing in 1916, not writing specifically about virtual worlds or digital games. But again, in writing about virtual worlds, we see this idea that many users, many players, don't just create one virtual identity, but rather we create multiple virtual identities, multiple avatars, and kind of establish this kind of distributed multiple personality order. Already back in the 90s, Sherry Turkle was writing about this distributed self, which you can play out in multiple virtual worlds. And Mark Hansen talked about this as being key to the idea of the virtual, right? The sense that that addresses this capacity, which is kind of fundamental to human being, that we always feel that we are not fully determined by one actual state which we embody in our actual lives. And again, we can see this kind of in a lot of popular advertising surrounding games and so on. Go over this quickly. Now, what I wanted to talk about very briefly is, you know, again, there's some writing in game studies which draws on aesthetic theory and philosophy. Of course, you know, we talk about aesthetics in games, and Fink himself talked about this. Play isn't about an end result, right? So play isn't about kind of, even though play produces this play world, it's not that producing the play world is the object of the game. Play is the act of producing, not the product, not the end result of the play. Play is about the process, about the action. As a result, as Kanya said specifically about digital games, if we are going to develop an aesthetics of play, it has to be an involved aesthetics. It has to adopt the player's perspective as involved in the process of playing the game and kind of actions and reactions that involves. Especially if we're talking about digital games, I mean, arguably other kinds of games as well, but especially if we're talking about digital games, you know, another word for digital games is video games. And you know, focus on the video part of that, then we're highlighting this kind of mediated aspect of digital games. As Ryan argues, when we're playing digital games, we're acting, but we're also the spectators of our own actions. We're having this kind of, you know, the screen-based reality of games highlight the fact that we are acting, but we're also receiving, at the same time, this mediation of our own in-game self, act to us. You know, I argue for this kind of existential perspective on games. Games are also aesthetic at the same time. Sorry for the hand drawing, but I really hate drawing diagrams with PowerPoint. As I've argued in my own research, you know, the player inhabits that kind of ludic service position. You engage with the game world from that standpoint, internal to the game world. But at the same time, you still remain yourself. You have this doubling that Fink was talking about. You're still looking at the screen and seeing your own your own in-game self on screen. I've referred to this as the double perspective structure of ludic engagement, and if we are adopting this existential perspective and talk about that as an aspect of ourselves, which is being manifested in games, then this becomes a kind of autoscopic relation, right? A way of kind of viewing this version of yourself that you are enacting within the game. Kanye, I think we talked about it, the aesthetic situation, right? The fact that you can reflect over your own situatedness in relation to the game world. Finally, I'll go very quickly because I think I'm running short on time, if I haven't already gone over. Again, in my own earlier work, I've argued that when you engage with the game world from the ludic subject position, you are kind of enacting this ludic subjectivity, this self within the game world. And that is this particular comportment and way of being, which is defined by the parameters of the game, by the goals the game sets, the abilities given, and so on, but also to some extent by the player's own values and dispositions, right? If I play a game and you play the same game, we're working within the same set of constraints, but we might play out that ludic subjectivity differently, right? One of us might be more cautious, one might be more assertive. You know, there's some degree of talking about personal style here, for example, or by specifically invoking a particular set of values and structuring the ludic subjectivity. There's a paper by Michel Westerlund talking about playing Breath of the Wild as a vegan and imposing a set of constraints like not hunting animals, not using food derived from animals, or not using leather armor and so on. And so that is a kind of, again, that would be a particular ludic subjectivity within the constraints that the game provides. Now this ludic subjectivity is also mediated and available for the player's aesthetic engagement, right? You are seeing this on screen, you're seeing this quantified, represented, shown by the game. And just as a final thought here, in this final section, I'll talk about the ways in which that represented ludic subjectivity can take the form of a character. When there have been some kind of writing about games and aesthetics, people like Gérard Genette talked about this. He talked about how a particular player's performance in a game, such as a game of tennis, is determined, of course, by the constraints of the game and the vocabulary of actions the game gives you, but is also an autographic physical act, right? There's something, there's a way in which kind of playing a game, even though we're all playing with the same constraints, involves this kind of sense of making your own mark, right? Like creating this kind of autographic statement in a way, something which says something about the player. Now, I'm not going to go over all of these, but if we talk about character, it's kind of necessary to point out that character as a term, you know, in literary theory, in narratology, is quite complex. All of these kind of quotes suggest this duality in the idea of character. The character is both, as Martin Price has a verbal surface, right? The character is a textual construct, it's kind of words, but it's also this image of a possible person. Right? So a character is text, but it's also this kind of person who exists within the, or this image of a person who exists within the fictional world. And Marjorie Garber and John Trow, who have written two kind of recent, I think quite important works on character, also emphasize this duality in the idea of character, right? That a character is both kind of this textual construct that we see in a novel, in a play, in a film, but it's also something that we kind of ascribe to actual people. Like we talk about someone's character, right? If it's someone, you know, someone has a good character or something like that. The point they both make is that those two are very related, right? We understand characters in fictional sense as being representations of people, but in the way we understand people in the idea of character, by analogy to these kind of ways in which fictional character is constructed and textual character is constructed. This is a bit of a long quote from Frau, but I'll kind of highlight just a couple of relevant points from this definition. First is this idea that a character in the textual sense is constructed through this process of attribution. You read through a text, you kind of accumulate details regarding the character. but also, as he said further down, character is about real, that kind of textual construct is this analog of real person, and there's this really close analogy between how we understand character in a textual sense and how we understand what it means to be a person, a physical body, a moral character, a sense of self, and so on in the actual world. Again, some of my own earlier work, when I have talked about character in games, I've drawn on Yuri Margolin's quite structural, let's say, approach to looking at how a character is constructed in text. So Margolin argues a character is produced through characterization statements. Anything in a text which tells you something about the character. So character building happens when you work through a text, you kind of encounter one characterization statement after another, and that builds up into this image of a person, right? You group those statements into traits, repeated patterns, and so on, and you arrive at the sense of, okay, this is the kind of person this is. First, he talks about, so the first category of characterization statements are static mimetic elements, so fixed facts about the character, their name, their appearance, their customs, their habits, and so on. In games, we often have these same kind of things. We'll go very quickly, almost at the end. So in games, we have the same kind of things when it comes to defining a character and the characters we play in games. So then there's also, of course, dynamic elements, which are what a character does, their actions in games. And this is where it gets perhaps a bit interesting with regard to games and our kind of ludicrous activities as characters, because on the one hand, we have the acts which are performed by the character that we're playing, you know, of their own volition in a video, like in a cutscene or as a scripted event. But then there's all the event, there are things that we perform as that character. So, for example, some of the ways in which kind of our characters are constructing games. This is a game called Disco Elysium, which came out a couple of years ago, and it's like many RPGs, it gives you this capacity to kind of define your character through defining their kind of statistical attributes. So, for example, here we have a character, someone has built up a character that has kind of quite high motorics rating, quite low psyche rating. Here instead, we have someone who has a much higher psyche rating, for example, and that kind of suggests, okay, these are going to be very different characters, they're going to have different abilities, they will have to exist in the world in different ways based on those abilities. Once you start putting those abilities into action, again, you're going to play out kind of certain choices and so on. So, to give one example, right? Joel in The Last of Us is quite a defined character, right? There's choices that Joel makes which are scripted, right? Those are easy to kind of attribute to a pre-written character in a more traditional sense. But switching back to Disco Elysium, right? The game gives you the option to do certain things along with others. You can choose to, you know, wear a funny outfit and, you know, get up on stage and sing in the bar, even though you're meant to be a police officer on a murder investigation. That kind of says something about the kind of character you're playing. You're actualizing a particular way of being. And that game kind of recognizes the kind of character you're playing by giving you these badges, right? A kind of achievement, right? If you kind of choose particular dialogue options and express left-wing like or Marxist opinions, you'll get the badge. You know, if you employ critical theory 9 times, you get the badge. It's kind of like highlighting certain repeated traits and saying, okay, so this is your character now, this is who you're playing. I mean, it's interesting also because this is a game which doesn't really force you to kind of find coherence in your character. You can get the badge for being the ultimate Marxist and also the badge for being the ultimate free market liberal. So, skipping a bit because I know I'm out of time. I've linked this also to Ricoeur, talking about characters being the way in which we kind of achieve self-understanding. Right, a character is the, you know, we understand ourselves by performing a narrative process of characterizing ourselves. So yeah, the character it says is this kind of portrait we paint from the outside. We look at ourselves and we say, okay, this is the shape I have as a character, but it's also a kind of indivisible style or essence to ourselves, or at least that's how we understand it. And this is kind of my last slide, I think. Frau, who was writing about literary fiction rather than games, argues that you know, there's this thing when we relate to characters, fictional characters, there's this kind of process of self-understanding which happens through our engagement with other characters. I would argue with games there's a similar potential, right, through this relation to this ludic subject which we're playing, which is both us and this externalized mediated character. We have these kind of versions of ourselves that we're playing out, which are mediated back to us and which we relate to, potentially at least, through this process of achieving some kind of self-understanding of these potentials and possibilities of ourselves. And that's me. Thank you for listening. I'm sorry I've gone a bit over time.